Live from New York, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Got my mojo working, but just don't worry.
I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You can watch today's show by going to Ustream channel and then searching for Gary Nall. Today we're going to talk about green leafy vegetables supporting your memory and how a different look at cancer could make a difference in people's ideas about what can cause it, how to treat it. A new study shows 20% of children are improperly diagnosed with ADD, and research proves that common viruses can lead to cancer, and much more on health and nutrition. Also, some good news for Professor Seralini. He headed a major research team in France that fed a group of laboratory animals, rats, a genetically engineered maize versus regular maize, and found that they grew cancer in the body, renal cancer, for example, over the lifespan of the rat. This was a major study, and it was originally published in a peer-reviewed journal. Then the Seralini was attacked by trolls and people representing the biotech industries, and then his article was retracted. He then had it republished again. Now we have a new scientific paper exposes how corporations censor GMO research they don't like. Jonathan Benson from Natural News gives you the newest information on this battle, and it's heating up. And the enormous amount of money that the genetically modified companies have, the amount of people they can hire, the time they can spend in attacking anyone who challenges the safety of GMOs is substantial. However, what is happening is that there are those individuals, scientists, clinicians, researchers, and journalists, and activists, who are all coming forward with important information on GMOs. And the weight of the evidence is simply overwhelming. They are dangerous. They were never proven safe. It was all economic and political. So now we're pushing back. And guess what? Virtually every week, another country in the world is saying no to GMOs. We list every country that says no to GMOs on our website. I might mention also on the website, because we are not Republican or Democrat, we're not left or right, we're progressive, meaning we seek the truth wherever it is. We have articles that we post, documentaries, calls to actions that impact people all over the world. We have a worldwide audience. And we will list all of the different countries that have said no to GMO and all the studies supporting a challenge to GMOs. Also today, there's fury after Saudi Arabia was chosen to head a key human rights panel at the United Nations. Are you kidding? This is the country that beheads people, that beats people to death, that flogs them for 1,000 floggings, that would kill them, rip the skin and tissue right off their body. They have some of the most warped rulers in the world, and they're going to have a say-so in human rights? Well, we'll deal with that. Also, time permitting today from Chris Hedges from TruthDig, what it means to be a socialist. I want to share that if time permits because of conversation that I had with this past weekend with Gerald Celante at the beginning, the first day of Occupy Peace and Prosperity with Ralph Nader and Professor Robert Thurman, having a discussion on this very topic. And I think Chris's comments are germane to that discussion. Also today, you don't know what's in your vaccines. You assume that they are safe ingredients, or the FDA, the CDC, the National Institute of Health, some department of government would protect you and your child or baby. You'd be wrong. One more piece of factual information, and this is from one of the finest, most respected, and honored journalists in the world, Janine Roberts, at a press conference. And at this press conference, Janine Roberts talks about her personal odyssey into the offices of the CDC and its meetings with scientists one-on-one to take a look how they were making the measles vaccine, for example. Information you've never heard before. This is exclusive to this program. No other media is aware of this. No other article has been written on it. That will be an exclusive on today's program. And by the way, Janine Roberts is the one who told the world about blood diamonds. There was even a movie with Leonardo DiCaprio on blood diamonds. She was the one who exposed the Aborigines being kidnapped in Australia. She was the one who talked about the inside conflicts in the Congo. She is simply in a class by herself of journalists, 45-year journalist, and has reported for the BBC and other outlets in the United Kingdom where she's from. So we have a really strong program, so let's begin. All of us know that we should be consuming more fruits and vegetables. The fruits, because they have polyphenols and antioxidants, the more colorful the fruit, the better. But also they have hundreds of chemicals in each type of fruit. Some are the same per fruit, but a lot are unique to a fruit. Hence, we end up with super fruits like mangosteen or noni or pomegranate or cranberry or tart cherry. And you could have anywhere from the low end of 100 to the high of 300 or 400 phytonutrients per fruit. We have the same thing with vegetables. Now, I generally use an oversimplification, and it is a simplification, but the fruits are really good for helping to energize and repair DNA and the antioxidants to defend the cell. The vegetables help turn off inflammation, the cytokines that are necessary to cause inflammation and hence can cause the destruction of a cell. Inflammation is a probable cause of cancers, diabetes, the destruction of neurons, and the laying down of plaque in the brain. The amyloid plaque leads to dementia and Alzheimer's, for example. So they both are very important. In a general rule, I say greens detoxify all the vegetables, and the fruits help rejuvenate. So you're using both cleansing and rejuvenation. Now, here's the latest on the green leafy vegetables and why we should be consuming them, and more often. First, because of our memory. A lot of work has been done showing that the green vegetables, the leafy vegetables, for example, arugula, or romaine lettuce, or bib lettuce, or the microgreens, which will be the future. This was published in the FASB Scientific Journal, a major respected journal, and it talks about in a recent study, participants examined the nutrition intake of nearly 1,000 older individuals. These were about 81 years old average, and they studied them for 5 years. And the previous research had shown that a plant-based Mediterranean-style diet can help prevent dementia and Alzheimer's disease. The data was collected using their studies, and cognitive tests were administered to keep track of mental functioning. Well, here's the takeaway message. According to the results of the study, those eating leafy greens were less likely to suffer cognitive decline. In particular, eating 1 to 2 servings a day had the cognitive function of a person 11 years younger compared to those who ate none. So, these findings are important, especially considering how many people over the age of 50 we have in America. And by the age of 50, your brain is substantially aged. You're already tipping into memory loss, cognitive decline, and dementia, Alzheimer's. All of those are on their way. You just don't know what day, what year, what month you're going to meet it. But they're all going to be there for you. And so anything we can do to help delay that, to prevent that, to reverse that, is good. Well, if you're able with 1 to 2 servings a day to be 11 years younger in your brain, imagine if you had fresh vegetable juice each day. Let's make it easy. Let's take two diluting juices, meaning they're easy to take, they're not bitter, but they give you a lot of juice and they have a lot of healing nutrients. Celery and cucumber. Let's throw in some green apple and then take your choice. You want some kale, some watercress, some Swiss chard, any of the mainly 60 different greens you could add in. And that gives you power. That means that a glass of juice is equivalent to at least two servings of vegetables. So for every glass of juice you're taking in a day, you're de-aging your body. So let's say that you were at a recent retreat and I had people drinking 12 glasses of green juice a day. They also drank some other juices, and these were 12-ounce glasses. So that meant that you were having somewhere around 20 servings of vegetables a day. Now listen to the testimonials on the final day. I've been doing follow-up with people to see how are you doing post a month. More energy, feel great, losing weight, my senses are returning, sense of smell, sense of taste, my vision is improving. In fact, just this past weekend, a person stopped me on the street, was not at the retreat, but following a protocol from a health support group we had done a couple months before, and said that he no longer has to wear glasses. In fact, when he wears glasses, and he didn't realize this for a week or two, everything was blurry. He went to his ophthalmologist who said, your vision is improving, and he's 64 years of age. He said, I never ate a lot of vegetables. I didn't like them. Now, every day I have 6 glasses of vegetable juice, and he said, I feel phenomenal. There was a woman who is 72, and spoke with her yesterday, and she said that she had irregular bowel movements once every 2 to 3 days, and she always felt fatigued, her skin pallor was off, and she said now that she's taking in the juices and eating more vegetables, she's regular, and her skin quality has changed, her tone has changed, her energy has changed. So there's a lot to be said for green leafy vegetables and juices. Then if you can eat more vegetables, good. Eat larger salads, better. Or you can take the most concentrated, powerful of all, and that is your compounding powders, because that gives you tremendous amount of green and its nutrients. So that's good news for everyone. I would say over the age of 27, that's when you officially really are getting old, over 27. And you're really old by age 50. Also, this is an interesting study that found that stress is directly related to Alzheimer's. This was published in the EMBO journal, EMBO, which is a scientific journal, and it was done at the University of Florida, and they found that the more stress you're under, you end up creating more cortisol. Now, cortisol is not bad. It's your flight or fight hormone. So if you need energy, you want that cortisol, but it only really spikes for about a minute to 2 minutes, and then it plummets. But also your blood sugar spikes right behind it. Remember, any time you are stressed, your blood sugar is going to go right up. Adrenaline goes up, and then insulin goes up. And you stress out the adrenal glands, you become exhausted, which is one of the reasons that most people are walking around tired and want to get artificial energy in the form of sugar or caffeine. So if you learn to de-stress by not always personalizing everything, and a simple way I do it is simply look at everything as information from which you can decide how you want to feel about it, what you want to do about it. Keep it out and keep it detached. Don't react to everything that is said or done that involves you. Simply say it's just information. Because if you over-personalize everything, you're going to be burned out in your adrenals. You're going to have constant cortisol. And here's what you didn't know until this study. Quote, these proteins that are created when you're under stress end up boosting the production of protein fragments. And these protein pieces, known as amyloid beta, clump together and trigger the brain degeneration that leads to Alzheimer's disease. So, the more stressed you are, the more likely you are to end up with Alzheimer's. Not good. Also, from Natural Health comes an interesting study on cancer admission by conventional medicine. Here's what it says, quote, "Cancer is a preventable disease that requires major lifestyle changes." And that was published by the National Center for Biotechnology. And now, how many cancers? About 1 million new cancer cases a year, and about 550,000 people die of them. And 99% of the people who develop cancer of any type go the orthodox route all the way, which is rather remarkable when you consider the success that many alternative approaches have had that have been documented, and yet no one wants to hear about them within the orthodox model. Why not? I once had a conversation with the director of the National Cancer Institute, and he was very honest with me. He said, there's not going to be room for two paradigms. There's only one, and that's what leads everything, all the research, all the funding, all the treatment. And I said, but what if it doesn't work? Does it make sense to you that if you have a toxic reaction disease, cancer is, that you treat it with drugs and radiation that cause cancer, even if temporarily in some patients you're able to get a shrinkage or elimination of the tumor, you're still destroying the immune system, because when the cancer comes back, and it frequently does, there's no immune system left to work with it, and then you end up telling the person there's nothing more you can do. And he agreed with me. He said, but he wasn't able to change it, even though he was the head of the National Cancer Institute. So, generally speaking, for the vast majority of cancer cases today, we know that poor dietary and lifestyle choices are the main causes of cancer, not genetics. And yet most physicians tend to support the belief that our genes are the problem, while at the same time telling cancer patients, well, just eat anything, just so you keep your weight up. And why do you have to keep the weight up? Well, because your chemotherapy and radiation has caused you to go into cachexia, the wasting away. I just had this conversation yesterday with a stage 4 cancer patient who was just skin and bones and had followed the protocols exactly as done and was near death. And when there's nothing more they can do, they send you home. They don't acknowledge defeat. They don't acknowledge wrong. Okay, so let's stop for a moment. Let's just be responsible and reasonable. If you've had 40 years and virtually 100% of all the money you ask for, the research, the scientists, the institutes, the technology, all made available to you, plus over 1 million patients a year coming to you, and you have a 97% failure rate with chemotherapy, wouldn't you think that maybe looking back on at least 14 million people who died following your advice, that maybe your advice should be changed, modified? If giving more chemotherapy to a patient after they have failed with the original chemotherapy is the only idea you have, then why are you practicing medicine? Because clearly you're not thinking. You're reacting to dogma. Recently, a board-certified oncologist, one of the most respected in America, a professor at a major cancer institution and university center, met with me. The person came incognito, did not let anyone know they were a physician, let alone a cancer patient. But what was important, they sent one of their own patients, who was terminal, had only hours to live, at most a day or two, didn't think would be able to make the trip. None of this was I appraised of, by the way. And when I was given someone who just shows up at my doorstep, dying, and you look in their eyes, and the person says, "Is there anything you can do to help me?" How can I say no? I can't turn my back on someone. Even if they die on the doorstep, I just can't do it. It's not part of my nature. So I welcome the person and I work with them. That person, as of today, a month later, is still alive. Still has terminal cancer, but is alive and has had quality of life and is appreciative of each day they've had. What was remarkable was the doctor finally had to acknowledge that the only treatment they could offer the patient was to double up and double the amount of chemotherapy they were offering. At that point, it was the patient who said, "Look at my hands, they are black from the chemotherapy. I am wasted away. I am in excruciating pain. I have cancer in every part of my body." And that's when the doctor wanted to see. And then spoke with many patients who had improved or reversed their end-stage cancer. Then the dilemma was, what do you do with this information? Well, this person wrote a letter, and that is appreciated because this oncologist, one of the most respected in America, said that she can no longer just practice the way she had and is now looking at a way to start to learn more about an alternative approach. She can still use her orthodox knowledge, but when I asked her, of the 20,000-plus patients you've treated who were advanced cancer, how many survived? She said, none. I said, well, wouldn't you find it interesting if I introduced you some physicians whose end-stage patients, a good percentage, survive? Yes. That means you're going to have to go to the Burton Clinic and the Brzezinski Clinic and the Revisi Center and others around the world, including Gonzalez, whose work still continues with his associate, and learn. If you want to come to New York, sit in my office and learn. If you can do that, then the next stage of your life could be helping people survive. So this whole idea that it's genetic is wrong. This idea that lifestyle doesn't count, you can eat anything, is wrong. We have thousands of studies, independent studies from peer-reviewed journals, showing diet does count. Genetics does not. In the next week or two, I'll be doing an extensive program on the myths of genetic engineering, the promises versus the reality. We will have some of the world's leading geneticists on this program talking about the failure of the Genome Project and the marketing of the genetic, because behind all this were people wanting to market the gene therapies. This is from a Dr. John Craig Venter, V-E-N-T-E-R, best known for being one of the first to sequence the human genome. And he's an American biochemist and a geneticist. His remarks at the 21st Century Conference ought to give us a sense of pause. Quote, "Human biology is actually far more complicated than we imagine. Everybody talks about the genes that they receive from their mother and father for their trait or one or another. But in reality, these genes have very little impact on life outcomes." Have very little impact on life outcomes. Our biology is way too complicated for that and deals with hundreds of thousands of independent factors. Genes are absolutely not our fate. End quote. And that's what from one of the leading geneticists in America. In fact, this is not new. In 1964, according to the United States Surgeon General's Advisory Commission report, quote, "smoking was identified as the primary cause of lung cancer, yet we continue to allow the sale of these harmful products. Could you imagine if a vitamin, if any herb, if any nutritional supplement was found to cause cancer as cigarettes do? Do you think that they would still allow that on the market for sale?" Many PubMed studies link diet to cancer. including a study done way back in 1981, clearly illustrating, quote, 30 to 35% of all cancers are diet-related. That was back then. Yes, at least 1 in 4 people eat some type of fast food every day. Over 10 billion donuts are consumed in the United States every year, and 20% of all American meals are eaten in the car. We clearly have a long way to go, and yet we have yet to acknowledge that it's what we eat, what we drink, that causes cancer. Let's just summarize this way. Overly processed, denatured, artificially sweetened foods, high meat or any meat in the diet, cancer. The browning of foods, bagels, donuts, rolls, pretzels, toast, muffins, your buns, acrylamides, cancer. Diet sodas, cancer. Caffeine, cancer. Alcohol, cancer. Sugar, cancer. So, one more reason to take an honest, objective look at what we consume each day, and then ask ourselves, why should we be surprised about cancer? Now, right now in the United States, we have a skyrocketing number of children being diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. I believe that probably 95% of these children are wired, meaning they sleep late, meaning they're going to bed way too late, and they're not getting a restful night's sleep, which adversely affects their immune system and their attention and their energy levels. So they wake up groggy, and they have to have colas or soda to get to their energy level up because of the caffeine. Some even each day have their espressos or coffee before they get to school. There's even a recent ad on television showing a mother giving her son, while he's getting up and from bed, a cup of coffee, the indoctrination process to commodify the son and to commercialize the brand is already underway. Using a cell phone all the time adversely affects chromosomes in the brain, causing all forms of mitochondrial destruction, brain fog, brain fatigue, brain confusion. Being in front of a computer does the same. Being inactive causes poor circulation in the brain. Eating foods that you're allergic to, especially any form of brain allergy food, like dairy frequently, then you're agitated. Then, on top of that, going to school, and what if that particular class was not taught by an engaging and an interesting and dynamic teacher? You're bored by the class, you're bored by the information, you look out the window, you're diagnosed. You fidget, you're diagnosed. You don't get good grades, you're diagnosed. So the criteria for diagnosing ADD and ADHD are extremely subjective. And yet they give you a drug telling you it's a brain chemical imbalance. All right, here's a message to all the school teachers listening. We have a lot listening. And conscientious ones who really understand that the role of the teacher is not to get them to pass a stupid test, but rather to learn to engage their intellectual faculties of critical thought. Let any doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist, pharmaceutical company give you a single study that proves a brain chemical imbalance is the cause for ADD, ADHD, depression, anxiety disorder, bipolar condition, schizophrenia. One study. It does not exist. They know it, yet they keep saying the brain chemical imbalance. It is a marketing ploy. If you cleaned up the diet, cleaned up the lifestyle, insisted upon kids going to bed at a certain hour, taking away their cell phones, turning off and unplugging the computer and television, say now. You want to do something at night? Do something radical. I mean so radical, your head will turn around like you were watching The Exorcist. How about reading a classic book? Read Rollo May. Most kids would just, college kids included, would just fall off the bed, fall off at the mouth like a fainting goat. Actually do something that benefits you. Then see after a week of that whether or not you're seeing a difference in the attention of the child. This study shows that 20% of children are improperly diagnosed. I would say 90%. Get rid of the sugar. Get rid of the allergenic additives. And get rid of the chemicals in their environment. Give them something engaging and positive, something constructive, something other than me and the narcissistic life so many lead, ground them in the reality of what it is, and then they're no longer one of the 10 million children given a label and given a drug every day and destroying their lives. I'm Gary Nall. Now for one other comment from our public health segment. This is from Jonathan Benson, staff writer for Natural News. Quote, setting the record straight on a controversial toxicity study that links Monsanto's transgenic corn and glyphosate herbicide Roundup to liver and kidney toxicity in mice, a new paper published in the journal Environmental Sciences Europe exposes the criminal science cartel that actively censors research into genetically modified organisms and biotechnology that goes against the status quo. Doctors John Fagan, Dr. Travick, and Dr. Thomas Bowen want the world to know that Professor Eric Seralini's famous study on genetically modified maize, MK603, and Roundup is a toxicity study that just so happened to uncover carcinogenic effects of MK603 and Roundup, both in combination and individually. The findings of this important study are indeed valid. They reiterate and serve as a legitimate baseline for further research into this controversial segment of industrial agriculture. Their peer-reviewed paper entitled, listen to this, wow, how about this? This is a peer-reviewed paper. Quote, The Seralini Affair, Degeneration of Science to Rescience, end quote, warns that retracting studies simply because they don't fit the official narrative for a particular subject is the antithesis of what true science is supposed to entail. They emphasize that the normal scientific process involves investigating new ideas and publishing the results, which then encourages others to do the same in either support of or rejection of earlier findings. Now, if you remember, Professor Seralini's study was retracted from the Journal of Food and Chemical Toxicology after a swarm of so-called skeptics and other anti-science fanatics demanded that it be pulled for primarily political reasons. It basically boils down to the fact that these controlled people didn't like what Professor Seralini discovered concerning the carcinogenic nature of Monsanto's GMO corn and Roundup, so they pressured and bullied the editors of the journal who published this paper to retract it. Their reasoning and criticisms were quickly exposed as invalid, as revealed in a comprehensive rebuttal. But little was done to vindicate Professor Seralini in his study and make things right. That's where this latest paper comes into play, challenging the scientific circles that stifles honest inquiry into controversial subjects, including GMO safety. Dr. Fagan and his colleagues say the growing trend towards pulling papers from journals simply because some people don't like their findings is wrong. And they are right. It is wrong. And by the way, we are a network that provides forum for people to provide what we consider are responsible statements on issues. I wish that other forums were open to that or other programs on, let's say, Pacifica. You mentioned 9/11, irrespective of the quality and integrity of the investigator, the basis of their science and evidence becomes immaterial. They're simply a blackout. Not only a blackout, the person is then denigrated. Even the show host is denigrated as some outstanding show host. People who are extraordinarily critical of the quality of the material they allow on their show, such as Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter, is attacked personally, ad hominem attacks from inside Pacifica, because she dares to bring on people who have evidence and provable evidence that could withstand a cross-examination in a court of law to show that evidence. And yet, on the supposed free speech network, no. No. It is an embarrassment to everything that the original founder would have said. If he were alive today, he would be ashamed of his network, Lou Hill. He would say, what the hell have you done with our original ideals and ideas and diversity and objectivity and fairness when we're censored? And even one doctor who listened last night to the special 1.5 hour special I did, which you can download on the internet, where I had a former executive director. I had two members of the national board share about the problems of Pacifica and, most importantly, solutions, lots of solutions. And I received a paper. I'll read you the letter. And I just want to say, I appreciate that when a person is wrong, they have the character and strength of mind to acknowledge it. Because all over Pacifica, there is rumors rampant on every day, on every level, but there's also small cliques that keep people off the air, that keep ideas off the air, because they deem them a challenge to their ideology or to their political interest or to their financial interest. It's good to know when someone sees they were wrong and says it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world, and we have a worldwide audience. Thank you for being there. I will have Ralph Nader and others on the program talking about the new movement that we are starting and why we believe that this movement will be able to make a difference and cause legislation at the state and national levels and cause Americans to start to gain back the power that we've been losing to the special interests and the oligarchs and the corrupt technocrats, bureaucrats for a long time. By the way, 8 states support Vermont and fight against Monsanto and GMOs. This is just in today. Quote, the state of Vermont decided that it would listen to the people and require foods containing genetically modified ingredients to be labeled. But with the help of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, Monsanto and other biotech interests launched a lawsuit against the bill that was passed. Thankfully, Vermont stood strong and is fighting back. Now, 8 states join Vermont in saying no more to Monsanto's genetically modified organisms. Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Washington filed a friend of the court brief in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York City in support of Vermont's GMO labeling law. The reason Monsanto and members of the Grocery Manufacturers Association are shaking in their boots, they could end up having to pay $10 million a day in fines for not labeling GMOs in the state. Governor Shumlin issued a no-holds-barred response to their complaint, stating, quote, here's an idea for the industry. Just label your products, all of them, nationwide. 64 countries are already do it. I'm sure the food industry in America could summon the moral imagination to be the 65th, end quote. So, more and more challenges against Monsanto and other biotech industries. Also, I wanted to share a letter. This came in after the post, and this is from a medical doctor, and he says the following. Steve Brown alerted us to the fact Gary Null was going to do a 1-hour special on the problems of Pacifica. I felt it was nothing short of terrific, and I feel pretty embarrassed about a bunch of stuff. His analysis seemed spot on. His guests, Steve Brown, Janet Coleman, Summer Reese, were eloquent to beat the band. Gary's list of suggestions, Steve Brown oozing with ideas that could turn this mess around, Janet and Summer's insights show me that the network could be saved if we had good, smart people like them at the top who could get stuff done. Everyone needs to listen to this one. Our broadcast over at the Empire Network. Here's the link, and then it goes on. Then he says, it ran from 78 What makes this show so upsetting is the cataloging of the most outrageous nature of offenses that have brought Pacifica to its knees. It is further upsetting that bright people, if they could run the joint, could have, maybe still can, help Pacifica. I said some negative things about Gary's health show, but even there I am ashamed. Why? Here comes Mitchell's question again. Have you actually listened for yourself, or are you just parroting other people's evaluations and opinions? The answer is, I haven't. And frankly, I'm ashamed of myself for not listening myself and being specific in my criticisms and questions. It sounds like Gary welcomes people to debate him, but I have chosen to be a sideline critic using other people's opinions in internet write-ups. As such, I'm ashamed of myself. I need to listen and cite chapter and verse of his errors, not treat him or anyone else in this matter, and I apologize to him for what I've written when I've refused to do the heavy lifting of doing my own personal homework. I'm not going to rip at anyone anymore unless I have personally listened and, with what I know of biology and medicine, brought forth my specific arguments against his specific points. He also cited a case of over 100 full-on sexual assaults that appear to have occurred in New York at the station that are known to the upper echelons and have gone unexamined and uninvestigated. Catholic priest assaulting little boys, anyone? I end the hour humiliated and disgusted. I'm disgusted with myself for my lax analysis, my parroting of others when the data is easy for me to get myself. Angry to beat the band that there are ideas out there that could help, could have saved Pacifica, but no, it has to die. It was a hard hour for me on a personal weep for Pacifica level. I make myself sick with some of my own behavior. And I apologize for lobbying crap at him without doing my research and homework. If I want to criticize him, I owe it to him to do my effing homework. What kind of doctor, committed person to research and truth am I when I make assertions without any effort at research and just act like a parrot of others? I disgust myself. So in addition, I appear to be an intelligent and scientific goofball and fraud. I tell you, I'm upset about the whole damn Pacifica thing with myself that I run out of words. And so, to Gary Nall, your show was terrific. We need a revolution. We need 100 shows like tonight, not one. We need an action plan to take back these stations, and we need it now. And I apologize for criticizing you when I didn't lift a finger to listen or do my own research. What the hell has Pacifica become? What have I become? And then it asks if anyone could get this letter to me, should, and I did. And this is a medical doctor. Now, here's what's important. It's okay to be critical of anything, but do so based upon measured research. Do your listening, do your research, and then if you have a problem with what is said, fine. Then you bring that to someone's attention. And then if there is indeed an error, then that error can be corrected. That's not the issue. The issue is at Pacifica, people frequently don't want to hear what you have to say, won't look at your research. The best example of that are the ACT UP people, who, when people like myself have spent decades helping people with full-blown AIDS, written a textbook on AIDS, and the largest chapter in that textbook, AIDS, A Second Opinion, was on how to help people with AIDS-defining illnesses, over 145 pages on just alternative therapies. They've written over 30 articles on AIDS, including the longest article ever published in the Townsend Letter for Physicians and Patients on protocols to help persons with full-blown AIDS. And most importantly, at the Tri-State Healing Center for 7 years, helping over 1,200 persons with life-defining AIDS conditions and creating protocols that became the standard for alternative doctors in America working with people with life-challenging AIDS patients, and then taking those patients onto Tony Brown's PBS Journal, who spent weeks evaluating their blood work up, their medical records, making sure it was only the protocols that were being used, no other drug. And then to be told you're an AIDS denier when you've done more to help people live a longer life than anyone else in the United States. No doctor, no activist do I know of personally who has worked with more people who are long-term survivors than what I've done. So if you want to be critical, that's fine. No problem there, but do your homework. What I was critical of is the politics of AIDS, The special interest groups who have profited by hundreds of millions of dollars collectively off AIDS, the foundation that make money off AIDS, and I hold the same disdain based upon my research that I did for the cancer establishment and the marches for cancer and the marches for AIDS. None of those marches will help prevent a single case of cancer, nor treat a person effectively and holistically. It's all about who's behind the scenes, and that's where my investigation has been done. So, for this doctor who is believing in those lies and hence not listening but making decisions and criticisms, thank you for waking up. Thank you for being responsible today. My hope is you become a critical thinking part of this audience and therefore use your background, use your medical degree, use your study and your learning and your scholarship to further arguments and discourse rather than impugning people's reputations and engaging in mob rule. And that's what Pacific has become, and that's why it is faulting itself instead of thriving as it should. Listen to the podcast, or listen to the archives. I think you'll appreciate it. I have invited people on every issue that we discussed on to debate. We've invited Monsanto. We have invited the people in the chemotherapy industry and the radiation industry. You should see how many invitations we give people to come on the show to share their points of view in a respectful manner. None take up the offer. I don't know why. I won't assume, because I don't know. So we continue to offer information, and we'll do so. Now, let's change it up a bit. I want you to hear Janine Roberts give us her insights based upon her first-person research. And to this physician, have you ever been in a laboratory where they're actually making vaccines, ones that are now mandated? And if you have not, would you ever have imagined that this is how they're made? Please listen in to Janine Roberts, one of the greatest investigative journalists in world history.
Some years ago, I was flown by British television to Washington because there was an emergency meeting taking place there, that a monkey virus was being found in human cancers, and they thought it probably came from a vaccine. After attending this meeting, my co-producer and myself, there's only one other journalist that sat through all the meetings, everyone else went home after the press conference. And when I came back to England, I organized searches in the archives. Well, over the next few years, I kept on searching for more documents, and I found they had follow-up meetings at the NIH, that's the National Institutes of Health, the biggest scientific institution in the United States. And I found there'd been meetings between the scientists of the UK and the United States, the vaccine safety scientists, the ones that are responsible for the health of our children. What I found were documents that were recorded, transcripts, no journalists present in the room. They then filed away with no note of on what they're about. So you have to read through lots of documents. But this is what I found. I found descriptions of how they made the vaccines. The measles virus, just are the same as the mumps virus, same as the yellow fever virus, is grown on the embryos of birds. They basically get fertilized eggs, wait till there's an embryo, kill the embryos, mash them up, and put them in what they call an incubator. They then wait 2 or 3 days, and they add some previous culture, similar culture to it, and then they pipe off the fluid from underneath the cell culture to be made into the vaccine. They filter out everything bigger than a virus. They filter out bacteria. But they can't filter out viruses because they want measles, mumps virus in the vaccine. And what these scientists, named scientists at our senior establishments have reported, this means there could be prions, mad cow disease could be in there. There could be oncogenes. They say this. We don't know if they're there. There's all sorts of cellular debris from the dead birds in the vaccines. Do we filter this out? No, we don't. Have we purified the measles virus? No, all the live virus vaccines are minimally purified. And quote, unquote, they're saying that. So a vaccine contains every normal licensed vaccine, every one of the vaccines our children are getting, contains fragments of DNA, fragments of RNA, genetic codes that these scientists report are highly mutagenic, and they say at these meetings, well, they could cause autoimmune diseases and cancers. And they've got no reason to say they don't. They simply say we don't know what they're causing. The chairman of the meeting said, well, have we tested it for the amount of free DNA from birds? And they said, no, we haven't tested it. We have got no way of testing it. This is before they add aluminum, and it's before they add mercury or any other adjuvants. This is what all vaccines, they call it the substrate. And one scientist from Britain said, if the Greens in my country heard about what we are discussing, they would demand immediately the ending of all vaccination. Because we simply don't know what's in our vaccines. I mean, it's quite foul how they make the measles. I then went to, only last year, I went to the records of the Centers for Disease Control in Washington, a major research laboratories, to find out how they isolate the measles virus. And I didn't expect anything like HIV, because we, you know, surely this is one error. There is a paper that I've uncovered at the CDC, and it's called Isolation of the Measles Virus. It says if we think a patient might have measles, got spots, get some fluid from that patient, a sample of their urine or a swab from the mouth.
Start from when the measles have spots. You rub the
I'm sorry.
Okay. Start from where, sorry?
From the spots. The measles.
So I'm not quite with you, sorry.
Start where you say, check the symptoms if they have spots.
Check the symptoms of the patients. If these patients have got spots, if it looks like they might have measles, but you want to prove they got the measles virus in them and isolate that measles virus, what you do is you take some fluid from the patient and put it in the fridge. This could be some urine, it could be a swab from the mouth with some saliva. So that's what you got to test. But all viruses are produced by cells. So the next thing you've got to do is get a marmoset monkey. If anyone's been to a zoo and seen a marmoset monkey, they're the ones that are extremely lively and got long tails. Kill it, take its cells, and put the cells in the cell culture. Because they're 10,000 times more responsive to measles than our human cells. That's what it says. But the cell culture isn't ready yet to grow measles virus. The next thing to do is to make the monkey cells cancerous. I say exposing them to radiation. You mortalize them, as it's called. Still not ready. Next thing is you give those monkey cells Epstein-Barr syndrome, which is a horrific disease. You're still not ready. Next thing, you add a toxin to the cell culture that is so dangerous that the advice is wear rubber gloves. Don't let the human skin touch it. The CDC says at this point your cells are starting to fall off the side of the laboratory vessel. In other words, they're poisoned, they've got cancer, and it's some Epstein-Barr syndrome, and they're falling over. They're ill. Give them 2 days to recover and add some nutrients. Now, get the sample out of the fridge from the patient and add it to these deceased cancerous cells. Watch with a microscope for 2 days. If after this time 50% of the cells are distorted, Then you have got an isolate of measles virus, and you're instructed to put it in the fridge and keep it, because it could be used as a vaccine. At no point, you would notice, at no point is a measles virus seen. No point is a measles virus proved to cause the illness in the cells. We know they're poisoned. We know they've been given cancer. We know they've been given Epstein-Barr syndrome. That is now ready to be made into a vaccine to put in our kids. This noxious mixture is a basis that can be used for vaccines. This is current today on the CDC website. They've actually, if you dig deep enough, you'll find these instructions for the lab technicians are in place on their website. I'm sorry, it's nearly speechless, because I mean, we've all been hearing about how bad is HIV for the last 3 hours, but this is what they do with our kids. This is how they isolate the measles virus. It gets a little bit worse, I'm afraid, too. The meeting I got the transcripts of was co-chaired by a representative of the World Health Organization, and she reported to the meeting that chicken leukemia virus is in the measles vaccine, and they haven't been able to remove it. It's in the measles vaccine all over the world, not just the United States. It's widely distributed in the vaccine. They've known about it for 10 years. They've never told the public. They talk about the dangers of avian flu virus. Well, chicken avian leukemia virus to me sounds much more dangerous. They inject it into our kids. So I went to see how long did they safety test the vaccine off for signs of cancer. I found out 48 hours. Now, we all know cancers take years to develop. Why can't they test for longer than 48 hours? It's said because their cell cultures don't stay alive longer. So these cells that from the monkeys that have been poisoned, given cancer, die within 2 days. So they can't test to see what's happening to the chicken leukemia virus. I think this is enough evidence to have measles virus withdrawn now. I'm sorry. I've been horrified by what I found.
Exclusive report. So now you have been told by one of the greatest journalists on the planet the truth about what's just in one vaccine. I'll give you another part of this on another day when she talks about what's in some of the other vaccines. And it's even worse. So piece by piece, we find the truth. But the truth is not at the pharmacist, it's not at the nurse's station, it is not with a physician who's willing to give you the vaccine with the assumption that it's safe and effective. I would be supportive of any vaccine that was shown to be safe and effective for each person given to. My challenge is when I did the research, and I've spent over 8,000 hours studying the entire scientific literature, this is what we come up with. And nowhere have you heard this information I just shared. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Before we go, however, we have Luann Panessi on. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Another quick reminder for everybody. I'm still interviewing for our health support groups that start this Sunday for people with type 2 diabetes or for women who are in menopause and want to get rid of some of their symptoms. So if you're interested in our health support group, please give me a call on a 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And I wondered if I had a moment to read you something about that show that you did last night.
Well, we don't have time today, but be happy to take on another occasion. So our menopausal study group starts this Sunday. Our diabetes study group starts this Sunday. It's lifestyle and behavior only to see if we can help you make the choices that can turn your life around and hopefully save some lives, add some years onto your life, and the symptoms you thought you had to live with, see if we can have you, through your actions, make a difference and say goodbye to those. So give Luann a call if you'd like to be a part of it. It starts Sunday. I'm limiting it because the space is limited. One more time, the number, Luann?
631 504-6198. Just leave your name and number, and I'll call you back.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
I was all right for a while. I could smile.